My guest at this time is Leland Ryken, a professor of English at Wheaton College in Illinois, and he's also the author of many books, including The Legacy of the King James Bible. The year 2011 is very important in the history of the King James Bible, 400 years since the first printing, and of course it was ordered by King James I early on in the 17th century. So what is the significance of the King James Bible, both in terms of Christianity in the West, as well as our current translations of the Bible and the cultural significance it had even beyond the church? And Mr. Ryken, thank you very much for being with us.
Very glad to be here.
What was the original reason King James I ordered this translation? From what I've read, it seems like there was a political element here, even in addition to wanting a standard and comprehensive English version of the Bible.
I think that's a fair inference. We don't know the answer to the question you raised. The king called a Hampton Court conference to handle Puritan requests and grievances. The conference was a farce. This is January 1604. Nonetheless, from it issued the king's agreement that he would sanction a new translation and, in fact, help sponsor it. Why did he do it? He wanted a Bible that would unify the nation. That's an inference. We don't know that. Now, King James is a person that I would call a profane man. Nonetheless, he was a religious man, and he had a lot of interest in religious matters. So it was not out of character that he would be interested in a Bible translation.
What existed as a Bible before the King James Bible in the English-speaking world?
There had been, beginning with William Tyndale's New Testament of 1525, six successive translations, and then the King James Version. The Bishop's Bible of 1568 was the ostensible starting point for the King James translation. Let me just interpolate. The King James Version was not an original translation. It was a revision. Well, what about the Bishop's Bible? It had been initiated by Queen Elizabeth, and again, we can infer a political reason there, because the most popular Bible by far was the 1560 Geneva Bible. It's familiarly known as the Puritan's Bible. It had marginal notes that were unfavorable and hostile toward, A, the Church of England, and, B, the monarchy. The Puritans were democratic in inclination. So that had been an unsuccessful attempt to supplant the Geneva Bible. It was the stipulated starting point for the King James Revision. I have to say, though, more profoundly, the King James Version is a culmination of a whole century of English Bible translation.
We're talking with Leland Ryken, professor of English at Wheaton College. And so you mentioned a moment ago that it's not an original translation, but is it a faithful translation of the original manuscripts?
That is absolutely right. It is based on the translation philosophy that today goes by the name essentially literal, or word for word. Alistair McGrath, incidentally, has written a great book on the King James Version, has documented what we would have to call the extreme fidelity of the King James translators to the biblical original, even extending to syntax. But the more important thing is that the King James translation, and this, let me just say, was the dominant translation philosophy from William Tyndale right through the middle of the 20th century. Let's be clear about that. The goal is to provide an equivalent English word or phrase for every word in the original text. So that's the fidelity of the King James translators to what the original biblical authors wrote.
What did it mean at the time? What has it meant over the past 400 years for the propagation of the word?
For 400 years, when the English-speaking world spoke of, quote, the Bible, they meant the King James Version. It has been the central English Bible for four centuries, or for three and a half centuries, let's say, till the middle of the 20th century. It has meant everything in terms of the English Bible. And the cultural influence of the Bible in English-speaking countries is really solely the influence of the King James Version, and I would say right to the present day.
Talk about that a little bit more, how it permeated culture, which in many cases, certainly in the United States and perhaps even in England for most of that time, was a culture steeped in Christian tradition. That's ebbed away a little bit, certainly in the intervening years. But talk about how it permeated the culture then and how it has permeated the culture to this day.
One interesting glimpse into the extent to which it has influenced culture comes if we just start recalling public inscriptions. Where have we seen public inscriptions? Well, in the courtroom. We have heard it from the lips of presidents and prime ministers in England. If you go to the gate of Harvard University to this day, you'll see a King James verse right there at the gate. When I entered the University of Oregon Library when I was a student, I could look up and I could see, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." Visitors who file past the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia can read the verse from Leviticus about proclaiming liberty to the nation. Or if we turn to, let's say, music, think of Handel's Messiah. That's just a specimen of what we find in the history of Christian music. It's, loosely speaking, all rooted in the King James Bible. Even some of the great painters, such as Edward Hicks, painting the Quaker painter, painting the Peaceable Kingdom, he often puts the verse from Isaiah that he's painting right there on the frame. Let me just provide a summary statement. For nearly 400 years, in every cultural sphere we can name, the King James Bible was the main influence. Education, childhood education, the arts, political discourse, and then, of course, religious discourse, sermons. Think of religious plaques in homes. Think of Bible verses on the walls of churches. Everywhere we turn, the King James Bible has been central.
You teach a class, it's a class I also took when I was at a different school as an undergrad, called The Bible as Literature, and so it's obviously looking at the scriptures from a different context. What do you appreciate most from a literary perspective, in addition to, of course, of all the spiritual aspects?
Well, the Bible itself is a literary book, so a good translation preserves, let's say, the poetry, the cadence, the flow, the exaltation of it all. Well, the King James Version does it. I used the King James Version through my college years, and then I used a modern translation in that tradition. So I can honestly say I have never relinquished the presence of the King James Version in my life, even though I have used updated modern translations that perpetuate the tradition. If I could not have had a Bible in the King James lineage, I don't think I could have had the career I've had as an expert in the Bible as literature. It takes a faithful rendition of the original Bible, which is a very literary book, to produce a literary English Bible.
We're talking with Mr. Leland Ryken. He is a professor of English at Wheaton College. He's the author of many books, including The Legacy of the King James Bible. Wheaton is a Christian college, and you've served there for more than 40 years there on staff. So in that time, obviously, other translations have been used and so forth, but when you look at the students that have passed through, your own life, your colleagues, the significance of the Bible from a spiritual perspective.
I want to interpolate here something. In the middle of the 20th century, we not only lost the kind of Bible the King James Version had been, a Bible with stylistic excellence, we lost also a common English Bible. And with the proliferation of Bibles, we've witnessed a great decline in biblical literacy. And we see it on Wheaton's campus. We see it in our evangelical churches. And we need to take stock of that. The proliferation of English translations has not led to a golden age of biblical acquaintance. It has led to the opposite. That was an unexpected fallout. But now that it's documented, I think we have to take stock of it.
Mr. Ryken, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for your insight and helping us understand the significance on this 400th anniversary.
Wonderful.
Leland Ryken is a professor of English at Wheaton College in Illinois. He's the author of several books, including The Legacy of the King James Bible. And as we leave this story, we leave you with a reading of one of the most famous passages, which is entirely appropriate at this time of year. It's the first 20 verses of the second chapter of the Gospel of Luke. And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And all went to be taxed, every one into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea, unto the house of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was that, while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. And there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid. And the angel said to them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you, ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. And it came to pass, as the angels were gone away from them into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, Let us now go even unto Bethlehem, and see this thing which is come to pass, which the Lord hath made known unto us. And they came with haste, and found Mary and Joseph, and the babe lying in a manger. And when they had seen it, they made known abroad the saying which was told them concerning this child. And all they that heard it wondered at those things which were told them by the shepherds. But Mary kept all these things, and pondered them in her heart. And the shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things that they had heard and seen, as it was told unto them. The birth of Jesus Christ, as recounted in the second chapter of Luke in the King James Version of the Bible, which is now 400 years old. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.